Hey there, welcome to SaaS Inbound Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me is Finn, co-founder and CEO of Schematic, a solution that allows businesses to quickly integrate pricing and packaging into their application with a few lines of code. So you're merging pricing and product, or pricing and development. I would love to get deeper into this. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna.
Sure, absolutely. And you know, I wanted to ask you, like, which part, like, where are you coming from into this? Are you coming from the pricing perspective or the development, the product perspective?
It's a great question. So, you know, maybe kind of to give you a background story on the origin of the company. Yeah, I had my first company I ran for about 10 years. And, you know, it started out as a lifestyle business. We pivoted into a software business. We eventually raised venture capital. The company was acquired 10 years into the journey. And as I reflect on that first company, I think one of the biggest mistakes I made was around pricing and packaging. And it was a mistake that was made repeatedly. You know, it's like constant guesswork. Then I joined a larger company. You know, about 6 months after my first company was acquired, I joined another company that had just raised a lot of money from Insight. And I got to be at that company for 2 years while we tripled growth. And I wore several different hats. I was director of growth. I was chief of staff. I was VP of ops. And sort of across all three of those roles, I ended up owning pricing and packaging. And it was a really cool experience because I got to own it sort of end to end. So like, what should the pricing be? How should it evolve? But also implement any recommendations that garner approval across the executive team. And so to your question, like, I got interested in pricing both from the strategic side, but also from the implementation and operational side. And on the latter front, that became particularly interesting because, you know, you could go do all kinds of price analyses and cohort analysis and elasticity and come up with a good idea and a good recommendation and get approval. But what we ran into was that it was quite hard to actually implement our recommendations. For us at that company, it took us nearly a quarter, 2 quarters, in fact, to release a third tier on a relatively simple product. And that got me really interested in why that was so brittle and so painful and led me to founding this company, Schematic, which I can talk all about. But I'm interested in it from both lenses, but the company that I have founded is very much tackling it from the product lens and the implementation and operational lens.
That's super interesting. And, you know, while you were talking about owning pricing, I remembered I had a few people here on the podcast that were talking about pricing and, you know, somehow it just got to be a bit more of a topic the last year with AI, with people trying to figure out how it fits into their pricing strategy. And at SaaS Group, we have this internal SaaS Academy thing where we bring external experts to share their knowledge about a particular topic. And just before Christmas, we had a full month of pricing and we were trying to figure out because, you know, across our brands, we have so many different strategies that we implement. And it's always a big question, who owns pricing? And all the, I think now I'm wondering if I should compare all these episodes that I had with pricing experts and what, like, who says what and who should own pricing. But like for smaller, like earlier stage companies, I would assume it could be because you have like, what, 3-4 people there anyway, right? So it can be like founder, let's say. Where does it go from there? Like who should own pricing and how, you know, who will be going to the developers? Who will be going to the product people saying, hey, you know, we have this pricing thing going on. Can you help me implement it?
It's a really good question. And I think, I don't know that there's like a right answer. There are certainly sort of like strong opinions for different arguments here. I think you're right to say that it's very stage specific. Like if you're a 0-1 seed stage startup, like pricing should live with the founders, should probably live with the CEO. As you achieve product market fit, you know, and you kind of move into a world where the business is growing past 5, 10, 15, 20 million in ARR, you know, what you often see, you know, companies that are performing well with pricing do is set up, you know, good pricing committees, you know, sort of that have representation across the business from sales to product to engineering to marketing. And, you know, in some cases, you'll see even two types of committees, like an executive committee that's like there to consider things like ACV expansion or whatever kind of like the top line objective is of the business, as well as sort of operational kind of committees that are there to kind of ensure that, you know, whatever recommendation comes down from the executive committee can be implemented. Often that happens when, you know, a business has like some degree of material, like product complexity or commercial debt that they need to be cognizant of in the context of evolving and iterating on pricing and packaging. When it comes to like, where should it sit and who should be the owner? You know, I think I've interviewed 60 thought leaders on this very question. And I think what I've found is often you will hear people say it should live in product. Pricing is product. Pricing should be treated as product. Product needs to understand the value of what they're building so that they can build with a lens towards enterprise value. And if they can't do that, what are they building? What's the point? You sometimes hear, you know, valid arguments that it should live in finance, because in finance, you've got absolutely kind of like the traditional FP&A skills, the skills around cohort analysis, sensitivity analysis, elasticity analysis, discounting, governance, things like that. I think the right answer is it sort of depends on the business. It depends on the skill sets in the business. But you, I don't think you want to see pricing isolated in one function without a lot of cross-functional collaboration, participation, and pressure testing on how pricing will evolve at a company.
That makes sense. All right. Well, let's get to, you know, to the inception and, you know, what Schematic is now. And is it what you thought it would be? Like, were there any pivots along the way where you thought, oh, okay, well, it's going in a bit of a different direction, or like it's being pulled by the customers in a different direction? And what is the biggest problem that you guys are solving?
No pivots yet. I don't anticipate any in the near future, but you never know. So let's see. The story I was describing earlier was very kind of key for us from an origin perspective, because what was apparent was we're at a company that's tripling effectively. There's enormous product market fit. We've raised a lot of money. We're telling investors we can go displace multi-billion dollar incumbents. And the reason we can go displace these incumbents is because we can operate faster. Speed is our advantage. And suddenly we turn around and it takes us 2 quarters to implement a third tier on a relatively simple product. And you start to ask yourself, why is this so slow and brittle and constrained? And I didn't know the answer to it. And so it kicked off quite a bit of discovery, and, you know, discovery that was both internal but also external, you know, interviewing other companies to try to understand what they were kind of going through. And a lot of that discovery initially was focused on CFOs and FP&A people. Like, why is it so difficult for us to introduce a third tier? Why is it difficult for you? And I never got overly satisfying answers to those questions when I was talking to CFOs and FP&A leaders. Often the answer was, we just can't get enough engineering resources to support the iteration. And that led us to start interviewing engineers and CTOs and product leaders. And it was in the context of those interviews that were both internal to that company as well as other companies where we started to hear a really consistent answer. And the answer kind of invariably was something to do with entitlements. And if for those listening who aren't familiar with an entitlement is basically what should a customer have access to in a software product based on commercial context, like a contract or a subscription. And so what you'd hear engineering leaders describe is this gets really complex because of the way we have implemented entitlements into our application. And I'd say, okay, well, tell me more, what do you mean? And often they would say, well, we've done it in two ways, and sometimes in both ways. We've hard-coded entitlements into the application code and then tied them to a plan ID in the billing system. So effectively, very tightly coupling the application to the billing system. And kind of two issues invariably arose from this. You know, if you had hard-coded pricing into the application, you incurred an enormous amount of commercial debt or technical debt, because anytime you wanted to change pricing in the future, a change anywhere was a change everywhere. It was a change in application code. It was a change in the billing system. It was a change further downstream in the CRM, the CPQ, the ERP. Like, it was a massive refactoring across huge business systems, not to mention the application itself. So engineering always had to be involved. The business could never be iterative without pulling engineers off of new features to go support the latest pricing or billing initiative. So that was amazing to me. And then they'd also be doing this via feature flags. Well, you know, some of the great feature flagging tools out there like LaunchDarkly and, you know, Split and otherwise, they're kind of traditionally designed for kind of classic DevOps use cases like deployment and rollout of a feature. They're not designed for entitlement features or long-lived features. And so if you were trying to use a feature management system for an entitlement, you ended up with a lot of problems like flag hygiene, zombie flags, like flags in the code base that you lost track of. And that's just a hygienic error, nightmare for an engineering leader. And so in many cases, we'd see companies doing both of those two things. And so you kind of find yourself in this kind of situation where as a company achieves scale, as it supports multiple sales motions, supports hybrid billing models, seat-based, usage-based, maybe some type of outcome-based, as it tries to go multi-product, the evolution of pricing and packaging becomes incredibly complex. And that complexity often falls on engineering and product to figure out, because the business will come back to product and engineering and they'll say, we want to launch this next tier, or we want to unbundle a tier and sell this add-on, or whatever it is, we want to acquire this business. And now we've got a very multi-product sale that we've got to do. And so, yeah, I think that's really the origin, as we started to say to ourselves, wow, there's a really consistent thread here, and it's how entitlements are implemented. What if you could solve the entitlement problem? What would that do for businesses? Well, it would eliminate engineering from having to be a bottleneck on pricing and packaging evolution, and it would empower business stakeholders in product or ops or finance or wherever to go be iterative and to be flexible and to do so with a ton of control. And so that's the origin story. We founded the company in June of 23, and I can talk about the journey of the last 18 months, but that's how it all started.
Sure. But, you know, because you started to talk about kind of making it easier to align these two, and eventually I think making it easier for engineers to implement this, or even eliminating their involvement on some level, does it change the way you sell the product? Do you sell it to engineers? Like, do you add engineers as kind of like a mix into your sales motion? Or, yeah, who's the ICP?
Yeah, it's such a good question. Yeah, we sell to engineers. We view our ICP as the CTO. We're typically selling into early stage venture-backed startups, high-growth startups, early stage, and we're selling into the CTO. And often there's a champion in product or ops, but the CTO is absolutely the decision maker, because at the end of the day, like, the way we decided to build our product and design it is that it is a feature management product that is purpose-built to extend beyond deployment and rollout of a feature and into entitlement, entitling a feature, packaging a feature, monetizing a feature. And so the CTO has to be comfortable with our product. And if they are, and if they implement it, then the business user realizes all this benefit, because they can then control pricing and packaging flexibly with, you know, a UI that's very much purpose-built for the non-technical user.
It's interesting that you said you're selling to venture-backed earlier stage companies. Yeah. Why venture-backed?
I think that's just so far where we've landed. You know, like, I think what we see is, I don't know if that's kind of forever going to be the case, but it's companies that are so far trying to grow very quickly and dealing with a lot of complexity up front in their pricing model, because they're AI startups, or they've gone multi-product from the very beginning, or they're trying to support hybrid billing from the very beginning.
I think you also started in like such an interesting period, because, well, 2023, everyone's doing AI. And my colleague just recently, Dirk Salmer, he shared this infographic of like how different pricing strategies evolved the last like 20 years or something. In 2023 is when everyone started to figure out how to introduce AI and like how to add it to the mix. So I think it's a very interesting kind of thing for you to try and tackle. And I think you're right, like all the venture-backed companies are now either trying to add it or trying to start with it. And they have to iterate quick. And maybe that's where you guys are coming in.
Yeah, I think what has been maybe one of the surprises for me is when we founded the company, I think my hypothesis was this is a problem that emerges a bit later on in a company's life cycle. You know, the company that I described sort of experiencing this problem firsthand was a Series C company. You know, we were well into, you know, a couple hundred employees, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And so I assumed like this is a problem that emerges when a company like has gotten towards multi-product, gotten towards like hundreds of customers. This is starting to become a problem that can no longer be solved manually. What has been fascinating over the last 18 months is I think the problem is occurring much earlier in company life cycles than I had anticipated. And I think that is in many ways related to AI because all, you know, so many companies now are like from the very beginning, it's hybrid billing. From the very beginning, it's product-led and sales-led growth. From the very beginning, it's relatively broad product offerings because it's hard to go to market with like these very thin MVPs at this point. And so, yeah, it's been a really interesting learning.
How did you figure out your pricing?
gosh, work in progress. yeah, so what I would say is I think we've actually written about this. We've been quite intentional about it. The first thing we did is we had willingness to pay conversations with probably 30 prospects and design partners. And we approached those conversations with quite a bit of structure. It's typically 8 questions. And those 8 questions sort of result in sort of a body of information that allows you to proxy price and understand what the market is willing to pay, understand sort of the market's kind of top end threshold where they're unwilling to pay, understand where they feel like they're getting a real deal, understand how you might kind of package. So we did those interviews and that was very formative because it gave us confidence. And before we did anything with that, we also created sort of several principles around how we wanted to approach pricing, you know, and kind of one of those principles for us was we wanted to price for adoption. We did not want to maximize, you know, sort of price to value early on. That was not the point. And I think it's valid to be kind of take a very different approach than that. But that was one of our principles. And so sort of combination of willingness to pay principles were kind of the two things for us that were crucial. And, you know, where we landed was, you know, kind of early on, 2 different tiers. We were kind of very quick into 4 tiers. And we revisit pricing monthly in the context of our founding group, where it's basically, what did the last 30 days teach us about our pricing? Did it teach us that we are good for now? Did it teach us that we are running into material sales objections? Did it teach us that we're running into drop off from kind of the pricing page and product led? You know, we're kind of always asking those questions, but that's how we've approached it so far. Since we're selling to startups, you know, we're trying to be very accessible and we're trying to have a generous free tier. And we're trying to kind of, I should say, like our free tier, one of the things that we are kind of currently considering is sort of a reverse trial where you have access to everything for 15 days, 30 days, at which point you lose access because we do want to catalyze action. But that's how we've approached pricing so far.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
That's probably a great idea for, since you're selling to developers because they want to play with the product before they do anything. And I wanted to ask you, like, since you decided to sell to developers, and you know, I've been in your shoes, and it's been, let's call it a fascinating experience. It wasn't easy. Any like tips, anything that you've discovered that you know that helps you win developers and you know product folks?
Great question. I guess what I've learned about that is that was one of my biggest fears coming into this was I had encountered a problem as you know effectively like a RevOps person, a growth person, but the solution to the problem had to be a solution for engineering. Because if you didn't solve the engineering problem, you could not solve the ops or growth problem. That was the fundamental reality. And so, but I was afraid, like, you know, all kinds of imposter syndrome. Can I sell to developers? I'm not a developer. Is there authenticity there? And, you know, I think one thing that has been crucial is, you know, selling with your technical co-founder. There's very real legitimacy in our story to this being a cross-functional problem. And I can speak authentically to the way I experienced the problem, and he can speak authentically to the way he's experienced the problem as a developer. That's been really important. And so kind of the way we treat sales calls is I'm running qualification, I'm running sales process, but he is running the technical demo. And that very kind of quickly and easily solves any type of authenticity gap that we might have and allows us to build credibility in the sales process. I think the other thing that I've learned is that in order to build any type of real groundswell with developers, you need to focus on a community. We're focusing increasingly on Next.js React. You need to focus on developer relations. When I say DevRel, you know, what I mean by that is your documentation has to be exceptional. You know, your sample apps have to be exceptional. Your product-led experience has to be exceptional. That's a work in progress for us. You have to create a ton of technical content that's high utility, that answers questions that developers are asking, and that allows you to insert yourself into those questions with utility, not with something salesy. And then you have to translate those technical tutorials into videos. And then you have to translate that video work into relationships, real relationships and partnerships with developer influencers, so that you can meet the market with, again, utility and demonstration of a product that provides real value and eliminates pain for working software developers. So I think that's what I've learned. The final tidbit is I've been blown away by ChatGPT and Claude and all of that for what it's done to help me be a more technical seller on the fly in real time. I mean, I've trained GPTs on our docs, and so I'm better than I was a year ago by a long shot, because of what the LLMs have been able to do.
That's a cool hack. Okay. It wasn't there yet when I was in your shoes. So yeah. I think it might have helped a little. But yeah. Okay. And, you know, one of the biggest objections with developers is usually, hey, you know, I can build this overnight. Or, like, it's too easy to pay for this. How do you deal with that objection?
You know, I think I no longer want to be in a sales situation where I'm having to do heroics and where I'm having to convince someone to do something. I want to be in a sales situation where they're pulling product from me. And if I find myself in a situation where I'm leaning towards the heroic side, I usually stop myself and say, it sounds like you may want to build this. I'd love to know why. Why is this core? Why is this, you know, core to, you know, the innovation that you're trying to offer the world? And then I listen. You know, and there are occasions where there's very valid reason for a company to build this type of infrastructure. It's few and far between. I mean, it's few companies need to go build their own billing systems at this point, for example. Few companies need to go build their own feature management system at this point. But there's the occasional valid concern from a security perspective. But yeah, that's the approach I take is if you want to build it, we'd love to know why.
Yeah, absolutely. And how? And how much money you're going to spend on it.
Yeah. And you know, how do you think about the maintenance costs over time?
Right. Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you, because, well, you said this is not your first rodeo. And I'm always wondering, like, what were the mistakes that you made in your first business that you're trying to avoid or that you've learned from that you're doing differently this time?
Oh, so the first business was full of mistakes. I could write a book on this. Let's see. We started as a service business and we pivoted into a software business. So right there, you have an enormous amount of learning to deal with. How do you pivot from services to software? It's exceptionally difficult from a personnel perspective, a cultural perspective, product quality perspective. That's a chapter. When the business pivoted, it grew quite quickly to $1 million in ARR. And it felt like there was real product market fit. And we raised a Series A. And then the business, for about 3.5 years, could never grow past $2 million in ARR. We were stuck between 1.5 and 2. And that's frustrating, right? You've raised venture, like you're banging your head against the wall. Why won't this thing grow? There's clearly customers and demand and real revenue, but we're stuck. And I think what I learned most through that was product market fit is a bit of a spectrum and it can be a little bit of a mirage. And I think my commercial instincts in that first company as a first-time founder around what product market fit is were quite immature. It was very easy to tell myself stories that we were on to fit, that we had a semblance of fit. And I didn't have the tooling or the vocabulary to really pressure test and investigate the quality and scalability of that fit. I think in company number two, it's so much more objective. We're constantly asking ourselves if we have fit in this sort of maniacal, methodical pursuit of like objective reality. The market is pulling you. You're not pushing. I think that's the first thing I would say. There's a lot more there. We pivoted ICP a bunch of times looking for growth. We pivoted pricing indiscriminately looking for growth. You know, we did a lot of things sort of in pursuit of growth that were not all that well structured, that were a bit desperate in retrospect.
Okay. Yeah, I remember, you know, kind of the evolution of this product market fit topic. And a few years ago, it was this, you know, this North Star that everyone was trying to reach. And in the last couple of years, people have finally started talking that this is a spectrum. It does change. It does change depending on your stage of the company. It does change depending on your ICP, on your pricing even. It changes all the time. So it's no longer like this mirage, like you said. This is something, this one time in the life of your startup that you should reach. It's just a goal point that it's going to move eventually once, well, maybe not once you reach it, but at some point in life of the company anyway. So yeah, thanks for reminding of that. I think a lot of founders need to think through this.
Yeah, one of the questions I often ask on our podcast when I speak with founders is, when did you rationally begin to believe in your business? Because there's a big difference between like the irrational belief in the business for the first year, two or three versus you know that this is working. And I think the founders that are very honest in that answer are often those that are like the most sort of self-reflective and aware of like where they are in kind of the pursuit as well as where they are on the spectrum.
So when did you decide that this is something that works?
I think we're very much sort of in the early days. We're 18 months old. We released our beta product 2.5 months ago. We've got a couple dozen great customers that are trusting us for real infrastructure. So that to me is promising signal. There's no churn. That's very promising signal. We have, to me, like to prove real product market fit in the context of this can be a big, meaningful company, we have to demonstrate groundswell. And I think we're still a couple quarters out from having all the product that we need to be able to like truly create that groundswell, and then probably another couple quarters out before there's been time in the market to establish a brand that developers can trust and really get to believe in.
I just realized the company is 1.5 year old and you have a 1.5 year old. So yeah. How did that happen? You had a baby and you were like, okay, there is something else missing that will make my life just a bit more complicated.
Yeah, a 4-year-old and a 1.5-year-old. Yeah. I don't know, right? Like somebody once told me that if you start your company when your kids are really little, if the company is successful, then you can spend a lot more time with them when they're like 8, 9, and 10. And, you know, hopefully that happens.
Okay. All right. I want to, yeah, maybe I'm going to ask you for a hack later, and maybe that will be something that you can share, how to balance, you know, growing a company and growing people. But one of the, again, common questions here on the podcast is your biggest win and the biggest failure so far, you know, 18 months, no hard pivots, but was there anything that stood out?
Let me think about that. I think the biggest win, so when we started the company, we said to ourselves, we're trying to build real infrastructure for how companies monetize. And there is no point in investing 3 or 4 years of our lives here if we can't, within the first year, build something that at least a couple real companies will trust in production. If we can't do that, there, you know, even though we've got this big, beautiful vision, this is not worth pursuing at this stage in our lives, because it suggests something about our ability to execute from a product perspective. Within less than a year, within about 9 months, we had a handful of very solid companies that had begun testing the product and staging. And within about 10 months, they'd cut over to production. And I would say that was certainly the biggest win for the company, because it made us believe we can build this product in a way that companies will trust. And that was the most important risk to mitigate in the first year for the founders. Failure, I haven't perceived failure yet. I would say that there has been a very important learning. We wondered in the beginning, could we go to market with basically an entitlement service, effectively, you know, a layer between the billing system and the CRM and the application? And could that be a narrow wedge into the market? And I think what we realized was, no, you can't just enter the market with a narrow entitlements layer. You have to come with more fully baked product across feature management and billing. Because if you are narrower than that, if you don't offer enough functionality across both, it's just not enough value for companies to replace their homegrown infrastructure. That was an interesting learning, because what it kind of forced you to accept is we've got to invest more money in building a product before it's generalizably sellable than we had maybe hoped or anticipated.
That's an interesting learning, because, you know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, it's not about features. It's not about adding more features to get more customers. But at the same time, you have to understand how many features you still need and get to that point where it makes sense for other companies to use you.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's a great point. And yeah, well, the last question is always about a hack, right? And feel free to do it in any way you want. It can be something personal, or it can be about, you know, successful implementation of pricing and packaging, something that works for you.
I don't know. This feels like I'm evading the question, but it, you know, it's marry or partner with somebody great who compliments you, and co-found and partner with great people who compliment you. And life is a lot easier when both of those two things are in place, in my opinion, in my experience.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's a long-term kind of strategy rather than a hack, but still it works. All right. Well, thank you so much for your story. I think there are a lot of learnings that you shared, and I think it's a really cool thing that you're trying to solve, because, again, from all the conversations that we had here, I think most about pricing were just about the fact that, you know, you have to do it and you have to educate your customers on the value and just keep experimenting how, you know, pricing change is good for a company. It was never about, you know, how it affects the product and the processes. So that's a very interesting approach that you're taking.
Thank you. Yeah, pricing is a journey, and it is always like one of the things that we've often heard is like the only thing that ends up being true of a successful software company is that its pricing will change. And I think it's increasingly incumbent on CTOs to support that iteration, support that flexibility, and not have their developers go support the change every single time it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. So if, you know, if anyone wants to talk to you about pricing, packaging, trying schematic, or maybe even coming to your podcast, how is it best to find you?
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm on LinkedIn, Finn Glover. Finn like Huckleberry Finn, but spelled F-Y-N-N. And schematichq.com. I'm happy to talk about anything from you're wondering about your pricing and how it should evolve to you're thinking through, like, how do we actually implement this and set this up for real scalability from a technical perspective. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be on the podcast.
Sure.
So appreciate your questions and the style.
It's been a blast. Thank you so much for being here and take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.